In the coming week, leaders of the world's powerful democracies meet in Germany. NATO leaders decide on a new strategic concept in Madrid, and a UN Security Council vote on humanitarian aid for Syria gets close. It's June 23rd, 2022, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon, and today we're joined by Carla Robbins, CFR's Adjunct Senior Fellow, filling in for Jim Lindsay. Carla, thanks as always for being here.
It's great to see you again.
Well, Carla, let's kick off with some major summitry going on the continent of Europe. We're going to discuss first the G7 summit, where leaders of the seven wealthiest nations meet in Germany to discuss the most pressing issues. And take your pick. You have the ongoing Ukraine war. You have COVID-19 pandemic, which is still thriving in parts of the world, and climate crisis that the major industrialized powers are still trying to grapple with. Carla, can you give us a sense of this summit and its significance?
So, Bob, as you said, actually, it's summit season in Europe. And in addition to the G7 and NATO, you know, this Thursday and Friday, leaders are meeting in Brussels, where they're expected to offer candidate status to both Ukraine and Moldova. And, you know, I'm wondering who has the mug and tote bag concession for all of this. So the goal of these meetings is to project a united front against Vladimir Putin, and we'll see how well they do it, especially in the face of rising economic troubles everywhere. And as you said, starting Sunday, you know, the 26 leaders of the world's seven wealthiest democracies will arrive at a place called Schloss Elmau in the Bavarian Alps. And I went and looked it up. It looks really nice. These guys always go to a really nice place. It has free Wi-Fi and an indoor pool. And Ukraine, both maintaining and ratcheting up sanctions against Russia and ensuring continued economic support for Kyiv, will be one of the main topics, but not the only one on the table. You know, the contracting global economy and inflation brought on by the pandemic, by supply chain, and now the war are certainly have to be high on the agenda. And I suppose the question is whether they have a plan beyond lobbying the Saudis or pleading with the Saudis on how to bring down global energy prices. We're going to have to see. Ukraine fatigue is, you know, very much caught up with the global economy. I expect the leaders also to talk about the global food crisis brought on by the blockade of Ukraine's ports. According to the World Food Program, 45 million people are on the brink of starvation. I've been hearing, and I don't know, Bob, if you've been hearing this too, a few weeks back, that the White House was seriously considering providing a marine escort for ships in the Black Sea. We'll see if that comes up or if they've got another solution. They're going to try to regain, as you said, some rhetorical momentum on climate change when in the near term, there's a huge amount of backsliding going on. Germany's economy minister announced this week that they're going to restart coal plants after Russia cut gas deliveries to Europe this week. And the Netherlands, Italy, and Austria have also said they may have to rely more on coal. And just even when the finance ministers met a few weeks ago for this G7 meeting, they were talking about setting these really ambitious targets for decarbonizing their economies. And there's nothing more carbon intensive than coal. So, you know, this is really hard stuff here. And certainly there'll be rhetorical commitments here, but they're really caught in a very, very tough place, more than anything because of Ukraine and Russia. So last year's big news out of the meeting was the agreement on a minimal global corporate tax, but neither Europe nor the U.S. has been able to move that forward politically. I don't know how much of a big deal they're going to be able to make about that, because that was the big win last year and not a lot of progress. Finally, I think, Bob, the personal dynamics are going to be worth watching. This is the first summit for the host, Germany's new Chancellor Olaf Scholz, who's been getting, frankly, mixed reviews for his performance on Ukraine. He's been making big commitments on military spending, aid and deployments, and then dragging his feet on follow through. Also, one of his top aides a few days ago was saying, you know, Ukraine's really important, but we have to worry about Russia too, and sort of that Macron can't we get along with everybody thing. And so, you know, I think Biden's going to have to do a lot of don't go all wobbly on me thing going on at this summit. It's also the first summit for Japan's new PM, you know, Kishida. And more than anything else, it's going to be interesting to watch Biden's performance here and at the NATO summit. You know, if you remember last year at the G7, more than anything else, there was this huge relief that Donald Trump wasn't there. And, you know, and that Biden was at the table. But there were also a huge number of questions about how, you know, the longer term reliability of the U.S. partnership. And then things got much, much worse after the G7 because of that chaotic withdrawal for Afghanistan, that feeling of betrayal. And then the U.S., you know, cut France out of this deal for this very lucrative, you know, submarine deal with Australia, the AUKUS deal. So there was a lot of anger. And then the Ukraine invasion came along and some very deft diplomacy on the part of the Biden administration. So the sense of American leadership has been very, very strong because of Ukraine. And you have to give Putin a lot of credit for it, for pissing everybody off so much. And you have to give Biden's people a lot of credit and the president a lot of credit for providing strong leadership. But the real test is going to come now because the Ukraine fatigue, because the economy is very strong. So we're going to see the beginning of that at the G7. And we'll see how much Biden rises to the occasion first there and then at NATO.
Carla, you're exactly right. I mean, this is going to be really complex, but it also seems like in some ways it's a world situation that's teed up for an organization like the G7, or at least has the G7 had been traditionally constituted. You have these strong, powerful democracies still among the world's leading economies, and they're dealing with multiple crises at the same time. And they have the wherewithal to do something about it. But as you say, just looking at the energy picture, you know, really complicated. And frankly, as you alluded to with the Saudi reference and some others, some trade-offs are going to have to be involved in terms of with climate policy, with dealing with unsavory regimes, what have you, I think, to come out of this with a sense of direction. I think message discipline is going to be really important. I would note our colleague, Stuart Patrick, has an interesting kind of sort of scene setter blog post up where he basically encourages this approach where you don't make such a big fuss about democracy versus autocracy, but more like, hey, you know what? At the end of the day, we stand for supporting the rules-based international order, which is a yawner type phrase, but in fact is much more of a realistic approach to the current dilemma where you don't try to sort of hive off the world's democracies and sort of finger wag, but you basically say, at the very least, we expect countries in this world to abide by rules, abide by the UN charter that they have professed fealty to, and go from there. And that starts with Ukraine. And I think then lay out the markers for how they see the actions vis-a-vis Russia should be, the support for Ukraine, but also then how do you lift the world out of this food crisis, a lot of which emanates, but not completely, but a lot of which emanates from the Ukraine crisis. I mean, will there be, you mentioned the escorts in the Black Sea, or will there be some sort of extraordinary effort to provide some sort of land transport of Ukrainian grain out into Europe and into other markets, especially the Middle East? So it's going to be an opportunity for, I think, the G7 to really step up and show what it's capable of. But as you say, you know, really complicated questions and trade-offs.
So, you know, one other summit which we have to think about, which has been going on, which shows exactly how complex and on a certain level how depressing all this is, which is this virtual summit that's taking place right now as we speak, which is, you know, with the BRICS, I mean, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And it's Putin's, the R in the BRICS is Russia. It's Putin's first international summit since the invasion of Ukraine, and nobody left him out of it. It's him coming in from the cold. And that is quite disturbing because, okay, India, you know, India is also, it's invited to the G7 meeting. You know, India is part of the Quad. India is a democracy. You may want to say it's not democracy versus autocracy. India has been playing this very strange game here. It went to that meeting. South Africa went to that meeting. Brazil went to that meeting. Brazil, which just had, you know, a meeting with Biden, you know, also at the Summit of the Americas. We can feel very strong in the transatlantic alliance, and I think we should feel very strong in the transatlantic alliance. And I think the NATO summit will feel very good because NATO has a new sense of being and mission, you know, recovered sense of it. But there's a lot of countries out there, even though the rules-based international order, the sin against which all others are measured is you don't change borders by force. This should be an easy one, but somehow it's not an easy one for countries. And that BRICS summit, I find it really chilling. It's really chilling when you see the South Africans there. It's really chilling when you see the Brazilians there. It's really, really, really chilling when you see Modi there.
And this gets to another issue too, Carla, which is the role of China. That's China's going to be a backdrop to G7. And as we discussed in a little bit, NATO, in that there was this G7 effort to counter the Belt and Road Initiative, which some might call a nothing burger or a nothing plant-based product. But we'll have to see how that plays out.
Really impossible burger.
Or an impossible burger. There you go. Perfect. But it is, how do you counter, you know, what China's bringing to the table? And some countries have shown, as we just saw in the South Pacific, they don't necessarily want to be in China's suffocating embrace necessarily, but there needs to be some alternatives too, right? So it's a fascinating period. As you mentioned earlier, there's this EU summit, which you might have an outward hand extended to both Ukraine and Moldova, among other countries. You've got the BRICS summit going on of the alternative universe in some ways, but
no,
also maybe
the BRICS though, because it's virtual.
But it's virtual, right? And then in person, G7 and this Bavarian Schloss, as you mentioned, And then let's segue into the follow-on summit. So all of the G7 leaders, including Japan, which is a first, will then proceed on to the NATO summit in Madrid towards the middle of next week, Carla. That summit is occurring just after Finland and Sweden have made their historic bids to join the alliance. Can you tee up for us what we should know ahead of the NATO summit?
So the NATO summit starts Wednesday, as you said, in Madrid. And once again, the goal here is the same, to project united fronts against Russia. And there's no question that this time NATO is far more unified and energized than it has been in years. I mean, you know, this is none of this out of area, out of business, you know, deepening, widening, all these big existential questions we had for NATO. NATO was created for this reason, and it's back in that business. But there's still going to be a lot of difficult issues to discuss, starting exactly with what you were talking about, this next expansion. You know, this was supposed to be the biggest in-your-face Putin moment, you know, Finland and Sweden being voted onto the team. If you recall, you know, Russia's deal was, I'm not going to invade Ukraine as long as you roll back. You didn't expand, you rolled back the expansion. And what is he going to get? He's going to get two more new members, and ones that are damn close to his borders. So, you know, these countries more than meet the criteria, but NATO works on consensus. And so far, there's one holdout among the current 30, and that's Turkey, which is objecting because of what it says, or more to the point, Erdogan says. You know, both countries, you know, Finland and Sweden, far too friendly relations with Kurdish separatists and the PKK and Kurdish fighters in Syria. You know, Erdogan has a whole list of demands for his vote, anything from arms shipments to Kurdish fighters in Syria, to the extradition of Kurdish militants and journalists, followers of this U.S.-based preacher Fethullah Gulen, to Finland and Sweden lifting arms embargoes, which have been on Turkey ever since this incursion into Syria, to U.S. sales of F-16 fighter jets and readmission to the F-35 fighter jet program. You know, at the same time, they're buying air defense systems from the Russians. They're not going to get all that. You know, Sweden is set to introduce a tougher anti-terrorism law, which will cut off any ties at all to the PKK, I think. But, you know, what more Erdogan is going to get and what he's willing to settle for isn't known. I mean, does he really, really think that he's going to get a lot for this? He certainly, the alliance really wants this to move forward. Or is he just playing, you know, is he just currying more favor with Putin? We really don't know yet. NATO has been setting up meetings between the Turks and the Finns and the Swedes, trying to make it all work out before the summit. The Turks have been saying, well, that's not our deadline. That may be your deadline. So that's one of the big ones. Now, if you really want to show in your face Putin, in a sense that we're really strong here, that would be a great thing to have come out of the summit, but we'll have to see. You know, NATO's grappling with other big issues, you know, about the question of troop deployments on the eastern flank, how many more troops to hold off Russia. The number has already doubled since the invasion. The Baltics want a tenfold increase. You know, will most of them actually be deployed, or are they going to be standby troops, you know, which is what the Germans and the Brits seem to want? Are the deployments going to be permanent? Because up until now, we've been saying they're not permanent, they're rotational. You know, I think the symbolism of saying they're permanent, given what the Russians have done, would be a very strong and important symbol. And the main focus of the meeting, as you said, Bob, is the adoption of the 2022 strategic concept, which is NATO's mission statement. The world has changed a lot since the last one in 2010, which, as I recall, said something about NATO reinforcing its commitment to cooperation with Russia. I don't think it's going to say that this time. You can expect a lot of talk about disruptive technologies, climate change. But I think the things to watch most are how it describes the dual threats posed by Russia and China, whether there's any call to reexamine nuclear policy, which is a very neuralgic issue for many NATO members, whether it gives Europe clear new responsibilities, saying the U.S. is a global power, it's got other responsibilities in the Indo-Pacific, so you guys are going to have to be able to, you know, fight yourself, not just depend on the U.S. at times. Those are going to be the things that we want to look especially closely. And as you said before, Bob, you know, there was a time when it looked like the rising China was going to be the primary focus of discussion at the table here. Japan was invited to Madrid, as you said, the first time a Japanese leader's ever been there. South Korea's new president is there. Australia's new PM, they're all guests at the summit, because this was supposed to be, you know, a China summit in many ways, the NATO summit. And certainly there's going to be discussion of, you know, the concept of a rising China, you know, its conventional nuclear forces. But I suspect a lot of the public discussion is also going to focus on what these countries are doing in the Ukraine fight. And it was really interesting in the Shangri-La dialogue, you know, Kishida, the PM of the new prime minister of Japan, drew a direct link between Ukraine and what's going on in the Indo-Pacific. He said, I myself have a strong sense of urgency that Ukraine today may be East Asia tomorrow. So it's not that much of a stretch to have that sort of a discussion at NATO.
No, and that gets back to this rules-based international order segment as well, Carla. It's a really good point, and it bears repeating. They're meeting as a very nasty conflict grinds on in eastern Ukraine, where Russia appears to be steadily, sloppily, but steadily expanding its dominance, shall we say, in the Donbas region. And there's many expectations that it will, at some point in the coming weeks, be able to declare some sort of formal control over the Donbas, 20 to 25% of Ukrainian territory. And then what? What is NATO prepared to do to support Ukraine, Ukraine's viability as a sovereign state? What is it looking at doing to shore up its borders with Ukraine, its countries that border Ukraine, and especially the Baltics? And that's, again, as you said, where the Nordic, the new Nordic states come in particular, where if they do enter, they create all sorts of capabilities in the north that NATO hasn't had before, including the Arctic, which is another whole set of issues that we could talk about for a while. So it's another absolutely crucial meeting. It's got to navigate a lot of issues. I'm wondering, though, whether we're going to see any new kind of commitment on Ukraine, or there's going to be sort of careful balancing of language from NATO so that Russia doesn't feel unduly antagonized.
Well, you know, the NATO defense ministers made commitments, I think it was just last week, on more military aid. And there's an interesting discussion going on about whether or not, you know, Ukraine, you're hearing lots of different things from different Ukrainian officials about exactly how dire the shortfall is. You know, there's lots of stuff coming through. It's not coming through as fast as they need. And it's a difference from getting things from the West and the East. But I think you'll hear reiteration of what they've already committed. I mean, I think one of the biggest questions is probably, and I should have mentioned this when we talked about the G7, is, you know, I think they need something like $5 billion a month just to keep afloat. If they need that money, that's, I think, what the fund estimated. So they need money, they need weaponry, they need a lot of things. And, you know, Biden, of course, is going to be the one who's rallying this. I mean, he seems to be all in for defending NATO and all in for defending Ukraine. He's not going to be able to go back to the Congress indefinitely, and all of these leaders are not going to be able to go back to their legislatures indefinitely. But I think they're going to be certainly focused on keeping that pressure up. The EU meeting did not look, in the draft communique from the EU meeting today, did not look like they were going to make any new commitments. They're just going to emphasize what they've committed. But keep in mind, they made commitments just last week. So maybe they'll just trot out what they've committed in the last, you know, 14 days. Or maybe you know, Biden will push for new.
Yeah, and I think it becomes a game of timing as well. You have the U.S. midterm elections this year, where there's anticipation of Republicans flipping both houses and a new crop of Republicans as well that could be less pro-NATO, because the party already is sort of split in that regard. And then you have France, where we just saw this kind of astounding parliamentary vote, where you have on the left and the right parties gaining quite a bit. So Macron cannot, at this point, assemble a majority that supports his issues. And so I think you have somebody like Putin counting on that as fracturing the alliance as the onset of winter comes, and Russia sitting with this bounty of energy supplies and Europe looking around for alternatives. It all creates a tough situation that, you know, seems to create more opportunities for Russia, but nothing's guaranteed either.
It's true. Although if you look at the polling data, I mean, the support for NATO and the support for the idea of Europe, and Putin has done more for the support of the idea for Europe than pretty much anybody else has done in a really, really long time.
So no, that's true.
He certainly overplayed his hand, but cutting off energy supplies in June is really different from the squeeze that you're going to feel come November.
No, that's absolutely true. And you also shouldn't dismiss the scenes that are coming out of Ukraine and the Russian actions that have happened in and around that theater of combat have been brutal. And the more exposure to those, the more public opinion continues to be in support of NATO, which is among the reasons why Russia is moving vigorously to try to cut off any sort of access to information, certainly in its own publics, but also in the sphere of its near abroad.
Because it is a reminder to us, because, you know, we, of course, have the luxury of living between, you know, in a very big country between two oceans. And thank God, have not had many attacks on our own soil. But Europe's a really small place. And it's really easy when you look at what's happening in Ukraine and you see all those people rushing into Poland. Even if you're a member, you know, of the Western part of the EU, if you're old Europe, as Donald Rumsfeld used to do it, it's really there, but for the grace of God. You know, these people, they remember the Nazis and they remember the Cold War. And so, yes, you've got the energy squeeze and you've got inflation, you have all the problems that we have. But their historical memories are a hell of a lot stronger than our historical memories when it comes to the horrors of the Cold War and the horrors of World War II.
I must say, I didn't think in 2022 we'd be spending this much time focusing on Europe, although people of our generation, Carla, would you know, remember those periods fondly.
That's your generation, Bob, not mine.
My generation, sorry. We don't need to get into generational issues, but in general, you know, growing up under a period when Europe was seemingly the center of things, and now it seems to be the center of things again for a bit.
I know. I suppose the things we studied have come back. So, Bob, I'd like to take our discussion to the UN, something else we studied, where the Security Council will vote on whether or not to keep open the last and only border crossing into rebel-controlled Syria. What do we need to know about this vote?
Well, it's useful, I think, Carla, first a little bit of a reminder to another godforsaken pocket of the world that requires and that relies on international help, and that is facing a truly stressful period. So there's a rebel-held region of northwest Syria. It's in Idlib province. It receives all of its humanitarian aid through one border opening known as the Bab al-Hawa border crossing, if I got that right. It connects Turkey and Syria. And it's under a UN mandate. It allows deliveries from Turkey to the rebel-controlled northwest of Syria. Syria, by the way, the Assad regime controls about two-thirds of territorial Syria at this point. In this particular pocket, as I said, there's Turkish sway and there's rebel groups that hold sway that are, to some degree, work with Turkey and on some areas of control. And not the Kurds, I should note. Syria's Kurds control other areas of the country, and they are at odds with Turkey. But for this border to remain open, there needs to be an extension of the resolution. The vote is now planned for July 10th, I think. And there's a plan to try to extend it for another 12 months. There's concern that Russia will block the approval. In the past, Russia has shut down at least three other convoy routes that brought supplies into Syria. And Russia might try to seek some sort of leverage as part of its standoff over Ukraine. Russia has been a strong ally of the Syrian regime in terms of using its military brutally to clamp down and bomb rebel-held areas that many civilians live in. So there's a lot of concern. We just had a session in the UN this past week where the relief coordinator for the UN, Martin Griffiths, talked about the importance of this border crossing, saying something like, you know, 4.4 million people live in northwest Syria and 20% more people require aid in that region than did last year. So basically talking about hunger rising, medical cases going untreated without the medical supplies needed, people losing shelter, access to water, all the basics that are needed for sustaining life will be, you know, taking place in that area. The sort of hard calculation from the Syrian side is, although they're giving lip service to trying to meet humanitarian aids, is that they want the rebels to capitulate. They want to consolidate control and get on with reestablishing full control over Syria for the Assad regime. So we're nearing this period where there's a lot of commentary, a lot of discussion in Security Council chambers about this issue, and things are going to get very tense in the run-up to this vote. And, you know, we'll have to see whether at the end of the day, Security Council is able to step up on the humanitarian side. But there's a lot of reasons to be a bit doubtful right now.
So here's something that I don't understand, which is, why do you even need a UN Security Council resolution for the delivery of humanitarian aid? I mean, under international law, you can't block humanitarian aid. I mean, there's a million conventions that say that that stuff should go through anyway. Why do you have to have a UN Security Council resolution to do this in the first place?
It's a really good question, Carla. I think in areas of war, and Syria has now been at war for about 11 years or so, having the UN Security Council, the one chamber that can actually create binding steps and take binding action if those, say, resolutions are violated, that it's seen as an extra imprimatur of the international community that such goods will be provided free of harassment and danger and so forth. In Syria, it's been a fraught process since the beginning of its civil war. As I said, Russia's interceded and is basically seen without this resolution, without this kind of formal endorsement that is signed off by all Security Council powers, including the veto-wielding ones, Russia, China, United States, UK, and France, that those corridors become then open for attack and it becomes a very dangerous exercise. And despite what are supposed to be international norms on helping provide aid to people in times of distress, it is just the way the world has evolved at this point, especially in Syria, where you've had, you know, all sorts of things happen to both rebels, but just people living under rebel control in terms of chemical weapons, credible reports of chemical weapons being used and cluster bombs and so forth, the deliberate bombing of, you know, Red Cross or medical facilities that have been set up there. So I think it's a chance to provide this extra layer of, let's say, official credibility and support to provide aid as I said, it's not clear that this is going to be renewed, given the tenor of the debate going on and the real animosity that's developed now between Security Council powers we really haven't seen in a while, certainly in the post-Cold War era. I should note one more thing, Carla, which is that there have been reports recently that Russia has been supplying Syria with grain and potentially grain that had been loaded at ports in Crimea. So potentially it was stolen Ukrainian grain. Russia develops a lot of its own grain, has huge agricultural products of its own. But there have also been reports that Ukrainian grain imports that are now under Russian control are being diverted to Syria. That would be a truly harsh outcome of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So we'll see if any more on that front comes to light. But it just adds to the fact that the calculations going on and how Syria has been sort of part of this big power struggle going on. And this vote, it's supposed to be about helping, you know, 4+ million people could get, you know, become hostage to further geopolitics.
So can I ask you one other Syria question, which is, have the Russians, I mean, the war has basically died down, except in some of these pockets, but the Russians still have, you know, fighter jets there and Wagner Group people there, or have they pulled everything out and to transfer it to Ukraine?
It's a good question, but the last I have seen is that they have maintained some firepower in Syria some sway. There's a port that Russian naval ships are still occupying, and they maintain some sway there. They work kind of a loose coordination with Iran, which is overseeing Shiite proxies in other parts of Syria and has some Iranian officials on the ground as well, by many accounts. So there hasn't been a wholesale diversion of Russian forces from the Syrian theater to Ukraine as of yet. But it's, you're right, it has died down. It's certainly not, we haven't seen a level of fighting going on that we had seen previous years. You have also seen some of the Russian officers who were involved in sieges in Syria have been elevated to the fight now in Syria, especially in the Donbas. You saw the elevation of some officers after the Russian debacles when they're trying to seize Kyiv, for example, and were assaulting Kharkiv. So that gave a lot of thought to, and there's a lot of debate about whether we're just sort of seeing a repeat of Syrian siege tactics in eastern Ukraine. And that seems to be the case in some regard. Or people recall the Chechen wars of 20 years ago or so, some of that going on as well, which is pulverizing cities regardless of civilian presence until the other side submits and then going in and seizing power.
The difference is that, of course, this is in Europe, so we're all paying attention. And that's the incredible tragedy. I mean, just the what they did to Syria, and you know, everyone just stopped counting the number of people who have been killed, the number of civilians who have been killed, you know, years ago. And now this is, we're seeing what the Russians are doing because it's happening in Europe, and they've done it before. It's just horrifying.
Yeah, there was a bit of this saturation of, you know, people being able to take on what was happening in Syria. The numbers of refugees from Syria were enormous, and that was certainly a byproduct of what the Russians and Syria and its other allies were doing as well. But, you know, half its population displaced, 6 million or so refugees. And now we're approaching those numbers in Ukraine as well. And you're right, it's getting a lot more attention as a European country, closer to European capitals, and a lot more media able to get in and report on it. I'm not sure what media are left inside Syria itself. And that also speaks to the tragedy there.
Yeah. So, I think it's time to pivot and discuss our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. This week, our audience selected Israeli Government Falls. It certainly does on a regular basis. So tell us more about what this change means for Israeli politics. And is Bibi on his way back?
Yeah, if we're going to pick a figure out of that figure of the week, it would be Bibi, or Benjamin Netanyahu, who is continues to be around and is looking to be poised to come back into power. That is not a given by any means, but it does speak to the divisions in Israel. It speaks to his enduring popularity. Some polls have shown him still with almost 50% of support of the Israeli public. And he, by the way, still faces prosecution on corruption charges. And his presence on the political scene for so long was the reason why you had this unusual, very unusual large coalition that survived about a year. 8-party coalition included Israel's first independent Arab party as part of the coalition, and it could not sustain itself. There were differences across the ideological spectrum because it was so wide-ranging, And, you know, the breaking point occurred in the past week when there were not enough votes to extend this legal system, what had been a, kind of a routine vote that would come up to renew a five-year system for governance in the occupied West Bank. The several Arab members decided not to vote. It was considered sort of the last straw that prompted the prime minister, Naftali Bennett, a strong anti-Bibi politician in Israel, to basically declare the government was going to be holding new elections. As part of the arrangement, the power-sharing arrangement for this coalition, Yair Lapid becomes the prime minister. And so he will be actually the acting prime minister when Joe Biden visits Israel towards the middle of July, which is not insignificant, but and will also be presiding as they set up elections, which are believed to be going to happen in early fall. But it is a moment for Benjamin Netanyahu to potentially return to power if he can consolidate enough forces beyond his Likud party and galvanize enough, you know, public will to come back into power. It would be, I believe, the fifth Israeli election in 4 years if it takes place in the fall. And so it just shows this is a country that has, even in, let's say, less divided times, would rule with razor-thin majorities and coalitions. It's entering another unknown period. And it's a time of ongoing challenge for Israelis. You know, we've kind of talked our way past the COVID crisis, but that for Israel, which was out in the front in some of its efforts, that posed a lot of challenges. There have been recently increased Palestinian attacks on Israelis. There have been escalation in Israel's covert war with Iran. And it's got, you know, a complicated relationship with the United States in a number of ways that will be interesting to observe when Joe Biden comes, because Biden's going to be visiting both Israel and Palestinian territories.
And interesting, the White House was very quick after this, the government collapsed, to say that it wasn't canceling the trip. And I think, as you know, Trump went before one of the many Israeli elections and didn't hesitate to, you know, be seen embracing Bibi. And you know, just Biden will be meeting with Lapid, you know, which could be seen as an implicit endorsement. Trump didn't hesitate for his explicit endorsement. It'll be interesting to see whether or not Biden's people are more even-handed and meet with all sides of, you know, of people who are, you know, probably won't meet with Shas, or does Shas still even exist? But it will be interesting to see how they play that, because it really matters in Israel what an American president does when he's there on the ground. It has huge, you know, political resonance.
Yeah. And, you know, among the legacies of the Trump period, in addition to his overwhelmingly strong support for Netanyahu's government and for the Israeli position across the board on so many issues, Trump set in motion what was known as the Abraham Accords, and Biden administration has continued those, which is basically supporting rapprochement between Arabs and Israelis. And so will that continue as part of all of this, and how much momentum does that have? And, you know, the Biden trip is going to involve a trip to Saudi Arabia as well. Will those discussions involve Israel-Saudi relations as well? That could be very compelling development on the same time. But if you have a fractured political scene in Israel, what kind of setback does that pose? And so it's all going to be very fascinating.
Well, sadly, you know, and I know that I'm now dating myself, I still hope that someday there will be a revival of the peace process. And there was, you know, some hope that maybe Biden, because he is going to go to the West Bank and talk to the PA and talk, you know, that there might have been this possibility of something that was totally dropped by the Trump administration, which threw in completely with the Israeli side, that Biden might be able to begin some sort of a dialogue, the beginning of some dialogue, the beginning of some brokering role there. But with no, you know, with just a caretaker Israeli government in place, there's no chance of that at all. And that, too, is, you know, Jim Baker used to say that the Palestinians never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. Well, this is a missed opportunity for everybody.
No, well put. And it's also just worth noting that whether or not this experiment with having Arab politicians in a coalition is going to be in any way revisited, given that Arab Israelis constitute 20% of the population, some have been looking at this hopefully as, oh, maybe Israel becomes more of a broad coalition type country. At the same time, you have Israelis saying, you know, there's a Jewish character to the state that we should never step away from. So there's a lot of sort of identity politics going on as well.
Well, we're rewatching Fauda right now at home, and which of course is, the word is chaos. And let's hope that it looks like there's a little bit of that developing too.
Yeah, let's hope we don't approach the Fauda situation too much. It's quite an intense series.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. As we said, China hosts the virtual BRICS summit. Did they use Zoom? World Health Organization holds committee meeting on, oh my God, monkeypox outbreak. The next thing we have to worry about. And the UN Security Council meets in New York City to debate the UN assistance mission in Afghanistan.
And Afghanistan just endured a devastating earthquake. Well, please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles, books, and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Rafael Seward with senior producer Gabriel Sierra. Marcus Zakaria engineered this episode, and our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Bob McMahon saying goodbye.
And this is Carla Robbins saying so long.